You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 5th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy birthday, everyone.
Birthday.
It's not my birthday.
Happy birthday to you. National birthday. January 5th. It's an annual holiday.
Is this the celebration of all things, you know, flying?
No.
Wait, or
birds.
Is this like an English thing where you just celebrate women? Is this just like a cheap way to say Women's Day?
This is a national birthday in the United States of America.
Celebrating bird watching
fowls.
And bird watchers. And birds.
You guys would like that, wouldn't you?
Isn't it true that like a significant percentage of bird watchers are pedophiles?
Depends on how you define significant.
More than zero?
Any?
Now, it says here they celebrate through bird watching, studying birds, which I don't know what the difference is, and other bird-related activities. Now, what do you think a bird-related activity is?
Like bird photography?
I guess so. Bird photography, bird drawings, right? Painting.
Yeah, painting birds.
Little Audubon
feeding birds. Yeah.
Eating birds. I had chicken today. It was delicious.
But, of course, to celebrate Bird Day, thousands of red-winged blackbirds dropped dead in Arkansas.
Happy Bird Day.
Yeah, right? What was that about? Why did that happen?
Yeah, this was on...
Apocalypse.
On New Year's Eve. The latest estimates are that about 5,000 red-winged blackbirds were littering the ground in this one town in Arkansas. This was shortly after midnight, New Year's Eve celebration. The thinking is that it was due to fireworks. Now, fireworks are legal in Arkansas on the 4th of July and New Year's Eve. And red-winged blackbirds don't have very good eyesight, so at night they generally just roost in a tree, you know, hunker down, and they're generally not flying around at night because they can't see obstacles very well. But they were spooked out of their tree, and in the confusion, and there was also some lightning that evening with the fireworks and the lightning and the low light and the poor vision, they basically were crashing into trees. They were flying too low. They were crashing into each other.
It's a perfect storm.
Yeah, and thousands of them died. They've been examined, and they all have significant trauma, you know, which would happen from the fall, even if that wasn't what killed them. But so far, nothing else has been found. Now, one interesting point is that it is almost certainly not any kind of poison, toxin, or illness, or disease. And that's because sick birds are really not able to fly. So, you know, birds who are sick don't fall out of the sky. They wouldn't be able to fly in the first place. So that sort of lends credence to the fact that it was something physical. So we'll never probably know exactly what did it, but the fireworks explanation is the best inference at this time.
And Steve, I've read that there have been incidents like this before, actually.
Yeah.
But I don't recall it ever getting such publicity. This thing was all over the news.
Yeah, I don't know why. But yeah, these kind of things do happen. Apparently the bird density in this area of the country is very high. The report said it wouldn't be unusual for 1,000 birds to be roosting in a single tree. So that's why they were all one species of bird, because they were all basically together. It was one flock. And said, yeah, there were some starlings and other birds mixed in there, but it was predominantly red-winged blackbirds. So I was, you know, a little sad.
Steve, did you read of anyone taking this and trying to compare it to the biblical event?
Well, you know, there was lots of tongue-in-cheek comments from reporters, but I didn't hear anybody seriously trying to make anything out of this. Interestingly, around the same time, I think it was like a day or so before, there were thousands of fish deaths, a mass death of fish in a nearby river, I think a few miles away or so. This probably was due to some kind of an illness because it was all one species of fish, and there would be no reason why one species would be picked out of the many that were in the river. So they, you know, probably got a viral infection spreading through, you know, the school of fish and then all washing
and
up on shore.
More dead birds fell from the sky in Sweden the other day And also, millions of dead fish have been found in Brazil and New Zealand. So, Steve, you say you haven't heard anyone making a big deal of it, but you don't live on the internet like I do. And on the internet, it is a huge deal because the apocalypse is coming, and this is just another sign that shows us heathen non-believers that we should repent now.
Apocalypse now? Wow.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, it's everywhere. Like, yeah. People are, because, you know, it's that sort of thing where you pay more attention to dead wildlife suddenly cropping up here and there. And it's basically what Rapture Ready does. They just scour the news looking for any sort of apocalyptic news that might support their mm-hmm. theory that Jesus is returning any moment now. So yeah, you start to pay attention more to all these animals dying. And if they're still dying at the same rate as they always were, now you're paying attention and you're putting them all together. And
I have a question for Internet
fishy.
Girl.
Yes. Yes.
Why, in the return of Jesus and all this, why must millions of animals die in the wake of
because
the return?
Jesus hates animals. I don't know if you know anything. I don't know if you've ever read the Bible, Evan, but maybe
you've
heard
the
a little
internet,
thing called The Flood, where he just effing killed everything because the humans screwed up, just killed everything.
Yeah, one species screws up and 10 million pay the price. What's up
exactly.
with that?
Or that
the
time
fish were okay.
That well, some of the saltwater fish would be okay. But, yeah, I mean, pretty much everything devastated. And then there was the time that Jesus was getting rid of demon possessions. And what did he do with the demons? He cast them into a bunch of pigs, drove the pigs off a cliff.
That's right. And they had
not
bacon.
Not a fan of animals.
I think it was into a lake and they drowned, not over a cliff.
Whatever.
The pigs died. Yeah, the pigs died.
Yeah.
But we're going to get to doomsday predictions in a little bit. Oh. But first, this is our first episode of 2011.
Yeah, that's right.
Or 2011, whatever.
Hopefully not our last.
So this is our annual prediction episode.
I predict we're all going to die in the apocalypse.
What the hell? That was my prediction.
A zombie apocalypse?
Is it a kind of apocalypse?
So how did the psychics do for their predictions of 2010?
Let me guess.
I wonder.
Last year I covered Sylvia Brown and I decided to cover her again this year.
Oh boy.
She came out with pretty much the same level of ridiculous claims, stupidity wise. So one of the ones that I thought was really ridiculous was she said that weather is going to be more unpredictable than it has in 25 years.
That exact same prediction was made last year. I'm positive.
I found her recycling some too. She, I think, again predicted the cure for the common cold.
And it is sad that this is how much we pay attention to these people, that we recognize them.
Yeah.
We recognize when they're recycling their predictions.
She also said, please stop worrying about 2012. The Mayans ran out of ink. And that's basically why.
Ink?
Ink.
Ink.
Ink?
She said that there's a lot of media coverage about the UV rays and many products to protect people against them, but people are still often careless when it comes to the sun. Then again, people could pay attention and reverse this prediction right out from under me. I would certainly be all for that.
Yeah. So it's going to get worse unless
it gets
better.
Win-win.
Yeah.
The non-prediction prediction.
A little funny to read some of these. I mean, all the ones I'm reading are way off the mark. The economy will recover slowly and very slowly. Okay. This is Terry and Linda Jameson, the psychic twins. You guys familiar
Ooh.
With them?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
psychic
yeah,
we
twins.
Talked about them this
Yeah,
year.
They did that video once.
There will be a
form of.
There will be a hurricane in the Gulf Coast, but not in the magnitude of Hurricane Katrina. Wow, there's going to be a hurricane.
It's going to be. Non-predictable.
There will be several terrorist attacks in the U.S. and also in other countries later this year. Nope.
We'll see.
No, nope.
Judy Heavenly predicted the hospitalization for Queen Elizabeth. That did not happen. And the ghost of the late Michael Jackson will hover over the 2010 Music Awards. Not a very falsifiable.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Hover metaphorically. It'll be seen hovering.
Cartoonish. Casper, the friendly ghost kind of thing.
Now, here's what's interesting. She's predicted a cruise ship taken hostage at sea, but quick action by the Coast Guard keeps all passengers safe. Now, that did not come true. Although you could see why she would have predicted that, because just a couple year or two ago there were a lot of hijackings on the high seas, but no cruise ship. However, there was that cruise ship that became sick. Remember that?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So she might claim a pseudo couple hit for that. Although nobody made the plague ship prediction.
The plague ship.
And the possibility of appointment of a new pope in Rome. Yep, the possibility. There's always the possibility.
Yeah, the dude's like 900 years old.
Well, that's the point. You read these psychic predictions. More than half of them are not even predictions of any kind.
I know.
Just general statements.
Non-dictions.
Non-predictions.
There's one, Hayek, who's a lesbian psychic. No, a Lebanese psychic.
Oh, God.
Predicted Julio Iglesias' name will be in the spotlight once again. Julio.
Really?
Wow.
Is he still alive?
Doesn't say which spotlight. So that's about the level that we were dealing with.
Oh, checking Sylvia's website. And yeah, she combined her predictions for like 2009 to 2011, basically.
Really? But how lazy can she be? I mean, she's making $700 for a 20-minute phone call. She can't sit down for 3 hours and come up with some more crap?
Oh, God.
That eats into her important nicotine time.
You know what's so funny is every year I listen to her predictions and I watch videos of her and everything, and man, she has officially turned into a cave troll. I mean, her voice is like actually scary to listen to now. It just sounds like a machine at this point.
It's like Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Kind of gone back that direction. Exactly.
My precious career.
Precious is dead.
The kid's dead.
The kid's
Gollum.
Dead.
Gollum.
The Hobbit's dead.
Sylvia.
Now, of course, the psychics didn't predict any of the big news that actually did occur, like the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig explosion in April of 2010, or the Haiti earthquake in January of 2010, or the plague ship, as I said. Even things like, you know, Obama passing major healthcare legislation. Even the low-hanging fruit like that. What are some of the other big news items from this year they missed?
I don't remember this year.
Oh, well, how about the Chilean miners?
Yeah, Chilean miners.
Chilean miners. There were New Zealand miners. Mm-hmm. The New Zealand earthquake was huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For example, here's you ever hear of the psychic Nikki? N-I-K-K-I?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
we've
covered her before.
World predictions. She had 100 of them last year. She did 100 this year. World prediction number 15 for 2010. This was a 2010 prediction. Tragedy at an oil rig. So, you know, okay.
Yeah, except for that oil rigs are the most dangerous places to work. Like, they're in something like the top. I'm pulling this number out of my ass, but, you know, they're like in the top 10 most dangerous jobs in the world. So
you would figure if they really do have psychic ability and this is about as accurate as they get, it's worthless.
Right. It's worthless.
Yeah. Nikki missed a couple from last year. A tsunami in Japan didn't happen. Lost City of Atlantis will be found didn't happen.
I can't believe that didn't happen.
Worldwide
Wait, are we sure
power
that didn't happen?
Blackout.
Worldwide power blackout?
That would be bad.
It's a numbers game. It's all a numbers game. It's all selective validation. All you just throw out a bunch of predictions, and all you need is one decent hit, and
that's
you could coast. You could coast on that for a long time. So that's what they're all hoping for.
Exactly.
And they know people are going to forget everything they say anyway, unless they get a hit. So I mean, that's what it's all about. Just
plus they use very loose criteria. What's a serious, you know, event or a what's a tragedy in terms of an oil rig?
Right.
And, you know, when will it occur? Which oil rig? So basically anything bad could have happened in any oil rig around the country, which, as Rebecca said, is just about a guarantee. And you could claim victory. And, of course, if something really dramatic happens, then you're home free. You know, again, it's like predicting that there's going to be a major earthquake. Well, what's major? Where? What, you know? It's guaranteed to happen if you have loose enough criteria for validation. Well, how did we do with our own predictions last year?
Nailed it. I predicted I would be more awesome this year, and I was.
That was really your only prediction, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, because the previous year I discovered what terrible power I wield. I predicted that Michael Jackson would die, and he died. So, you know, that's not the sort of thing you just throw around.
Let's see. Last year, I did have a 2010-2011 prediction. I kind of hedged my bets a little bit. I said that we would discover an exoplanet roughly the size of Earth in the habitable zone with the possibility of liquid water on the surface. There was a couple of close calls, but I don't think anything really completely fills the criteria. So I'll just extend that for 2011.
Yeah, I predicted that we would, in 2010, finally get a handle on what dark matter is, what it's all about, and I failed.
Yeah.
Some of the research I've done, it seems that even more scientists now are thinking, what, you know, are we wrong about dark matter? And I think it's more from frustration of not really figuring out what this stuff is. Because I just think the evidence that there is something out there it's just too compelling to just wash away with say, a modified gravity or something like that. I think that there's just it's just too compelling, and it's just a tough nut to crack. And eventually we will, but we didn't do it in 2010.
So you're saying you failed?
You guys all suck at this, basically. Yeah.
So last year, guys, I predicted that Amy Winehouse was going to die for obvious reasons.
And how's she doing?
As far as I know, as of right now, she's alive, so...
Fail.
I predicted that the British Chiropractic Association would go under. And, okay, they are still technically in existence. Technically and actually, they are actually still in existence. But they did drop their case against Simon Singh, which means that they had to pay all of his, or I believe most of his legal fees, which has left them rather crippled.
They should go for an adjustment. Manipulate that, baby.
Yeah, so that's a pseudo hit. I mean, you'd count that as a hit, right?
There's still, when last we checked, one out of four chiropractors in the BCA was under investigation for fraud, which has taken up an enormous amount of their resources. So, yeah, I think that they're just barely treading water. So, yeah, I'm going to count this one as a hit.
Mm-hmm. All right, what do you guys got for 2011?
Now, are these general predictions or are these...
specific predictions.
Whatever you want.
Or do you
want
to do celebrity deaths?
I have three predictions for 2011.
They don't have to be celebrity deaths, Jay.
I already said my exoplanet one.
That was one I was going to say.
Go ahead. The exoplanet, roughly the size of Earth, with the possibility of liquid water on the surface. Here's my far-out prediction. The SETI Institute will announce that it has received the best candidate ET signal to date, one that will remain viable and will need to be examined with more sensitive equipment. So they won't be able to rule it out until they actually do more investigation.
Wow.
And my celebrity death prediction is Luc Montagné.
Who's that?
He's a scientist. He's a Nobel laureate, won the Nobel Prize for discovering the HIV. However, of late, he has taken up homeopathy crankery. So he's another fallen Nobel laureate.
Oh, my God.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's really depressing, too.
Yes. Yes.
So, and Steve, are you basing that prediction on that?
And annoying.
He's going to not be doing well, and at some point he's going to turn to that as a remedy? Oh, you don't care.
No.
Okay.
That's just my prediction. My gut feeling, Evan. It's intuition. You can't break this down into logic and evidence. What do you guys got?
Yeah, I was going to talk about a exoplanet being discovered, Earth-like, water and all that. But, Steve, you took that one. So
yes,
I'll give you my other one. Here we go. NASA is scheduled to launch the last space shuttle this year. April is the last scheduled flight of the space shuttle. Congress will extend the space shuttle program so it will last at least to the end of 2011, if not into 2012. They will not scrap it in 2011. April will not be the last flight. How's that?
Wow.
That's interesting. Hope
and
you're
we'll
right.
We'll know soon, right? We'll know relatively soon.
Do you have a celebrity death?
Yeah, I don't like celebrity death. It's kind of morbid. You know?
Hey, so far everyone that I've predicted has lived, so I think there's actually a protective effect to me predicting that you're going to pass away.
Well, obviously.
What else can you conclude? It's like Psy missing, right?
Celebrity death. I'll throw one out there and say Robert De Niro. There you go.
Robert De Niro.
Yeah, poor guy.
Now, the two young celebrity deaths in 2010 that were not predicted by psychics were Gary Coleman, 42.
Oh, yeah.
And Corey Haim, 38.
Mm, it would have been an easy prediction. In retrospect.
In retrospect.
Aw.
Bob, are you going to make a prediction?
Yeah, I got a couple.
Go ahead.
The world as we know it will end this year when we discover that we are all living in a simulation.
Cool. What is it? That sounds familiar somehow.
Are you saying someone's going to turn it off?
No, somebody, you know, well, I can't give too many details, but but we will be given very good evidence that we are all living in a simulation.
That would be awesome.
So my serious prediction is that in 2011, we will have our closest call with an asteroid ever. An asteroid, not gargantuan, but big enough that if it did actually hit the Earth, that it would have killed thousands of people.
That's good.
Wow. Ever,
that's
you good mean one. Within recorded
within,
history?
In recorded history, a sizable asteroid within the orbit of the moon that's going to come out of nowhere. It's going to be an Earth crosser that we had no knowledge of.
Wow, your predictions are really, really nasty, Bob.
Yeah, Bob, I'm a bit worried about you.
I really wish that does happen because my prediction. No, listen to my prediction. My prediction is that it's going to come close and it's not going to hit. But I think we need a kick in the pants like that for us to take stuff like that seriously because it could happen.
Okay.
But hasn't it already happened? This one's just going to be bigger than the ones that have already happened.
We had one or two last year that came in.
No, yeah, we always have some that we see as they pass us. I'm like, oh boy, look at that. But nothing. Yeah. But none of them were bad enough where we could have taken out, you know,
cities,
cities
like
if
Sydney
it hit.
Yeah. Like, thanks, Phil.
And Phil Plait's show.
Oh yeah,
University
yeah.
had Sydney wiped out with a meteor. So the Sydney Buster will come within the orbit of the moon, basically, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay. When I was in the harbor, I actually was thinking about Phil Plait's show and that model he had, and that was kind of weird, you know.
Yeah.
I guess.
Very weird.
Yeah. You have a prediction, Jay?
I have, yeah, okay, so I got, okay, I picked Nelson Mandela to die this year, not for any particular reason.
Okay, all right, that's sad.
That he's old.
Well, he is old, he's 93, so I'm just going with the statistics here. And my news item is that a significant cancer cure will be found this year.
Significant. Mm.
That's deliciously vague.
That was vague. Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Jay, that was vague enough to be professional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope you're wrong, Jay.
Bob, you really are dead.
Well, I know. All the money we make from treating cancer, I don't want to cure it. It's a lot of money, you know.
Bob, you're not supposed to say that.
Oh, it's a secret. Cut that out, Steve.
It's on the down low.
Rebecca, what do you got?
Well, mine are... pretty upbeat compared to Bob's, at least. First, I do think that I predict that the apocalypse will come. But it'll be good because all
zombie
of the
apocalypse?
Well, you know, like in those Left Behind books, you know, all of the creationists will be raptured away and we won't have to deal with them anymore. And so
that's kind of depressing, you know, because it'd be nice that they wouldn't be here, but it would also mean that they were right.
Yeah, but I'm okay with them being right if it means they're gone. I'm willing to accept the fact that I'm wrong. It's that they aren't that makes them so annoying. And the fact that they are wrong. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a Pyrrhic victory, isn't it?
Now you've thrown it all. Now I feel like it's a negative prediction. And
I like the asteroid one better.
Yeah, I like the asteroid one better.
I predict that asteroid Rebecca Watson will fly out of its orbit toward the Earth and destroy us all. So that's one. I also believe that I predict that Gary Busey will run for public office.
Okay. I thought you were going to say he was going to die.
You didn't let me finish.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There will be an assassination attempt on Gary Busey while he's running for office. However, he will not die, and he will be elected.
That's pretty specific.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's very specific. And Gary Busey.
By the way, is it an election year?
No.
It's not, is it? No. No, but
or for dog
they're going to hold this a special election somewhere.
Yeah. And like also,
Gary Busey's running. It's a special election.
he'll act in a movie, and that happens in the movie. Ooh. Maybe.
Or, you know, maybe he's just running for election, and he doesn't realize that it's not actually an election year.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll see how we do in 2011. I predict we'll do at least as well as the professional psychics. Professional, alleged, fake, fraudulent psychics.
That'll be hard.
Right. We do have a couple more prediction-related items. Evan, you predicted last year something about Mars, and you're going to give us the update on that.
My prediction last year about Mars is that in 2010, we were going to get official confirmation of the existence of life on Mars.
How'd that work out for you?
There you have it. Well, it depends on how you look at it.
Right. If you believe
wrong.
The tabloids.
If you believe the exactly, Steve. If you believe the tabloids who reported in late April of last year that that they claim that NASA, yes, made the announcement and it's coming and life on Mars, here it is. And then NASA followed that up the next day saying, ignore this tabloid. They're crazy. We did not say that, and we have no intention of saying that. So in a sense, it was reported, but it just turned out to be a fake report. Now, on the other hand, there was another article that I found from that was published in the Washington Post in September of last year. And may I quote, "We can now say there is organic material on Mars." And that the Viking spacecraft, their organics experiments at the time that hadn't found any at the time had most likely destroyed what was there during the testing. And this was said by Professor Navarro Gonzalez of the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
So what's that based on?
All right, so the story is that the Viking, part of what the Viking missions were was to test the soil and look for organic material. And at the time, they had done a study of the data that the Viking probes had gathered, and they determined that there were no organics in the material that they were sifting through. However, more recent information, discovery made by NASA's Phoenix lander in 2008, said that this was most likely a false negative, based on the limitations of the equipment that was used at the time and the scientists' understanding of the conditions at the time. So,
well, how could they say that?
False negatives.
They could only say that it might have been a false negative. That's still not evidence that there is organics. Just means that if there were organics, that analysis, the Viking analysis, probably would have missed it. That's not the same thing as there being evidence for organics.
I understand that. And like I said, it all depends on how you look at these articles.
Yeah.
how you care to interpret them. The other thing I learned this past year about keeping up to date with Mars is that it seems every week there's news about Mars in one form or another. I mean, I comprised just a quick list, and this is just a fraction of the items pertaining to Mars from last year. Scientific American in January made a similar prediction to mine, in which they said that there was going to be more evidence of life on Mars and possibly an announcement by NASA at some point. Another article from June 2010, possibility of microbial life on Mars. Let's see, fossil evidence for life on Mars. That was from an August one. There's going to be a new Mars orbiter launched in a few years. That was also Mars-related news. Possible contamination from our spacecraft going to Mars, right? They think it's all clean. You know, they try to decontaminate these probes and things as best as they can, but you can't get rid of everything. You simply can't get rid of all the bacteria. They have ways. They find a way. And you know, this contamination of Mars was a hot topic. It came up in several articles last year. There was the article I just talked about, in which they were talking about the reanalysis of the Viking information. And October 2010, they called it the Mount Rushmore on Mars, in which these cranks, a la Hoagland. Now, Hoagland wasn't part of them, but a bunch of other Hoagland wannabes, supposed professors and so forth, brought forth all these sculptures, pictures, enhanced pictures of the face on Mars. They're canals on Mars, tunnels on Mars, Mount Rushmore on Mars. They have basically opened the floodgates this past year about there being, you know, intelligent life still existing on Mars. They talk about other science articles, hot springs on Mars, more about fossils on Mars, articles about NASA covering up the fact that there has been life on Mars. You can basically, you basically have a whole set of science unto itself about Mars that consists of not only legitimate science, but a whole mirror reflection of all the crank and pseudoscience and bad science going on pertaining to Mars. It's practically a case, it's practically a field of science into itself, Marsology. I don't know what else you'd call it. And it takes a lot of effort to keep up with it all. And, you know, there's a lot of information being tossed around out there.
Well, Mars has the double whammy because, you know, in terms of why it's generating so much news. On the one hand, we're actively exploring, you know, this nearby planet, which is very interesting. But also, you know, Mars has captured the public imagination through science fiction for over a century. I mean, it's... You know, it's no wonder that it receives so much attention, both from real scientists and the cranks.
So the bottom line, Evan, is that your prediction was wrong, though, right? We're still right.
Yeah.
After all that,
I guess through all that, I have to say my prediction did not happen. And I was tempted to re-predict it again this year, but that's too cheesy.
So that's lazy.
I'm staying away from the Mars effect for a while.
Eat it.
There's one more prediction-related news item. This is interesting, actually. It's a little different. In 1931, the New York Times invited a bunch of intellectual celebrities of the time to make predictions about 2011, 80 years in the future. Not really sure why.
That's like a time capsule-ish kind of duration.
Oh, it's because it was their 80th anniversary, right? So it was... their 80th anniversary. They said, "What are things going to be like 80 years in the future of that?" So it's now 2011. So we could look back and see what people predicted in 1931 to get a feel for what they were thinking. And, you know, it's actually not too bad. I mean, some of the predictions were fairly conservative. So one that's interesting is from Dr. Mayo of Mayo Clinic fame.
Give me ham on five. Hold the mayo.
He says. So first he's talking about the status of medicine at his time. He says, contagious and infectious diseases have been largely overcome, and the average length of life of man has increased to 58. This was back in 1931. 58 years. The great causes of death in middle and later life are diseases of the heart, blood vessels, and kidneys, diseases of the nervous system, and cancer. So not too different from today, except I put cancer at the head of that list. The progress that is being made would suggest that within the measure of time for this forecast, the average lifetime of civilized man would be raised to the biblical term of 70, or 70 years. So he was predicting life expectancy would be increased from 58 to 70. At this time, life expectancy in
77.
It's about 77, 78 years in industrialized nations. Actually, it's a little bit older for women, in fact. Yeah, so not bad. You know, he undercalled it. Actually, we made more progress than he thought. So again, that was a pretty conservative extrapolation for somebody, a physician at that time.
Not too bad, especially Steve, since, like, you know, think of 1931. I mean, how long had medical science really, you know, science based medicine been around? It hadn't been around that long, right?
So 100 years, you know.
Yeah, even so, you know.
It only really just started to make progress, you know, with germ theory and antibiotics, et cetera.
And at that point, it was what, like 20? It added at that point 20 years to the to the lifespan?
Basically.
So. This one gentleman, Ogburn, made one prediction. He said was that humanity's most versatile servant will be the electron tube. The electron tube.
There you go.
So,
Plumicons. Okay. He also predicted that the U.S. population by now would be 160 million.
Yes.
Yeah.
And either stationary or declining. It's 300 million and exploding. Henry Ford, his prediction was way off.
Was it something about the Jews?
Yeah, right. Hitler will be our new president.
He said, we shall go over our economic machines and redesign it, not for the purpose of making something different than what we have, but to make the present machine do what we have said it could do. After all, the only profit of life is life itself, and I believe that the coming 80 years will see us more successful in passing around the real profit of life. The newest thing in the world is the human being, and the greatest changes are to be looked for in him. So essentially, what? Predicting a departure from materialism, something, a mood that was sort of in the air of the time because it was, you know, right after the stock market crash. So I think it was being overly influenced by very recent events.
And he was, I've been recently reading an old, sort of old book, a book called The Family, which is about the rise of this sort of weird political Christian movement that exists today. And he talks a lot about the way it started. And Henry Ford apparently met up with some of the early influencers of that movement and was quite interested in it and affected by it. So could have something to do with that.
Yeah. Michael Pupin, our civilization will create a new industrial democracy. It will give the workers a fair share in wealth. Michael, P-U-P-I-N, I think it's Pupin. So, again, sort of taking a political movement of the time and extrapolating it into the future. Not quite. So, as we would expect, you know, trying to predict 80 years in the future is hopeless. You know, even the most conservative predictions were off significantly, but it is interesting to try to put yourself in the mindset of people from 1931. You realize how long ago was that? 80 years. That is a lifetime. And how different things were.
They didn't even have TiVo.
I know. There was no TiVo. What the hell?
Oh, forget it. Internet? What? Talking about vacuum tubes.
Yeah, nobody at that time was predicting, saying anything that, you know, we would recognize as a real prediction of, you know, the way civilization has turned out. Hell, you can't predict 20 years in the future, you know?
Yeah, it's just going to get tougher, too.
We're going to go on to a real news item, although this one is kind of a pseudo-prediction, too. Surprise, surprise, some whack job religious cult is predicting doomsday. That doesn't happen
right.
Every year.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise?
Every year.
How much time do we have?
It's just till May. May 21st, 2011.
This year?
Apparently, if you go into the Bible and there's a verse that says that one day to God is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day. If you were to take that to mean that one day is literally 1,000 years, I don't know. Somehow this means that the world is coming to an end on May 21st, 2011, according to a bunch of people loosely organized through like a website and some radio programs, I guess. Yeah, if you go to wecanknow.com, you can enjoy all of their crazy rantings. Family radio is what they call it, and you can listen to their little radio show there. It's getting news because there have been articles done. There's one woman who's been going around to the news outlets spreading the word, and she's also organizing RVs that are apparently going to be traveling around the U.S. with signs and stuff, trying to, I guess, save people before the rapture comes. Yeah. I tried contacting them to see if they would let me on one of the RVs. I have not heard back yet, but I will, of course, let you all know if that comes about.
Yeah, this is Harold Camping, right? Evangelical station, family radio.
But Harold Camping is a person.
Yeah, Harold Camping is the guy who's making the prediction. But apparently he's made predictions of the end of the world before.
Didn't work out for him.
Yeah, it doesn't mean he's wrong this time, though.
1994, he thought the world was going to end.
What's interesting with these doomsday cults is that when the day inevitably comes and goes, and the rapture doesn't occur, and the world doesn't end, then they actually, that reinforces their faith somehow. They now feel that even more motivated to justify their belief system, rather than saying, oh, I guess everything was wrong then, you know? The scales do not fall from their eyes. They do not generally become disillusioned. They become more faithful. It's an interesting bit of human psychology at work there.
Yeah, none of them seem willing to bequeath their worldly possessions to, say, me, for some reason, starting on May 22nd, 2011. Not exactly leaping at the chance to do that. I don't know why. No apocalypse. They just sort of re-up and pick a new date, and they're twice as convinced for the next go-around.
Right.
So
then you get the hell boppers who, you know, make sure.
Yeah, of course, there are those who just off themselves,
right.
which is a worry. Like when I was reading these articles, they have these pictures of young girls who are in this, not girls, I should say, young women who look, they don't look like the crazy jean skirt wearing cult members. I don't know. That's what pops into my head when I think of a cult member.
They
look
Nikes.
Like normal. Yeah, they look like normal people, and it worries me that they're crazier than they look. Even I don't know. I mean, they're obviously crazier than they look, but I don't know. It's worrisome. I hope they don't kill themselves. That's all.
Right.
It's stealth crazy.
I mean, if this guy did a 1994 prediction and didn't do it then, I would hope that would be the pattern.
Yeah, unless he's just more committed this time, you know.
Or maybe he's just trying desperately to be relevant and get airtime and be anything other than anonymous and pathetic.
I don't know. I think that these people really believe it, though.
Oh, I think the people that follow it believe it. I don't know if the guy who's generating it that really, really does. Jay, tell us about printing solar cells.
The research was performed by a woman named Karen Gleason, who's a chemical engineer and a professor at MIT, along with a graduate student named Miles Barr and a few others. And what they did was they came up with a technique to print solar cells on a variety of materials that they described as delicate. So a few examples of these materials would be rice paper. They've done this on a few different substrates like rice paper, plastic, saran wrap, and toilet paper, which was basically in the title of the headline that I read, that they printed a solar cell on toilet paper. So I definitely had to open that up and read it.
So why would you print a solar cell on something that goes where the sun don't shine?
Oh, boy. Actually, I can answer that.
You can?
I really can, because a few years ago at Boston Skeptics in the Pub, we had a speaker named Andreas Merschen, who is a physicist at MIT. And he was speaking at Skeptics in the Pub about neurology and quantum effects in the brain, which is really fascinating. But the way I met Andreas was when he was giving a very brief talk for Nature Network about what he would do if he had $1 million or something in terms of research. And he talked about this grand idea that they had to basically, the end result that they were hoping for was that they could send a bag of random little bits of parts to someone in a developing country. And the person in the developing country could take this bag with one page of instructions, put together something that they would combine with a local resource, say, I believe he used leaves or grass clippings as his example, and from that create solar cells that could power, for instance, a small laptop or just the lights in their house, and it could drastically improve their their living situation. And it's really exciting to see that despite the fact that they don't have $1 million to fund this sort of research, it sounds like they're making really great strides. So yeah, that's the end result is basically power for people in developing countries who basically lack power in every sense.
Yeah, clearly the applications of being able to print electronics and specifically solar cells on a very highly flexible material is obvious, right? I mean, that would, you know, being able to cheaply, you know, mass produce solar cells in flexible substrate is good.
Well, yeah, if you look at the solar cells that they generally that they mass market and people generally, I'd say, put on the roofs of their houses, was it the silicon substrate underneath is what's really most expensive. I mean, that, you know, that the backing underneath is what is really what's, you know, really adds a lot to the cost.
If you and can, it's stiff and brittle.
Right, right.
Yeah, well, this technique that they have now is actually a dry technique. So what that means is it's solvent free, so it's really not, it's not doing anything to the substrate. So they can print it on there, and anything that they print it on will remain intact. And then it has a way of bonding to the delicate material. And if anything, it makes the delicate material much more, it's stronger, where it acts basically as a polymer once it's connected to the substrate. So they spray it on whatever the actual thing is that they're spraying. They said that it's a monomer, and you use multiple monomers to make a polymer, right? I don't know if any of you guys ever made that connection, but polymers are more than one monomer stuck together.
Yep.
Makes sense.
So they spray this vapor, which is a monomer, and an oxidizing agent onto the substrate. What that basically does is it creates something called a PEDOT, P-E-D-O-T, plastic. And this kind of plastic is actually conductive. So what they also figured out is that they can increase the conductivity by 1,000 times by controlling the temperature of the substrate when they create the substrate by analyzing it and modifying the temperature that they do it at. They found that nanopores are actually created in the substrate. And what they do is they lace these nanopores with highly conductive silver particles, and that's the way that they can make these different substrates.
Oh, it's a dopant?
Yeah, like, you know, make it super conductive. Super conductive compared to what it would have been without it.
You mean
it,
highly conductive.
I highly
use
conductive.
The term super conductive because the superconductor has a specific definition.
I wouldn't use that either. I don't know why you even brought that up.
Yeah, it's deep. Go on. Go on, Jay.
So what they did was they printed the solar cells on, like, as an example, rice paper, and they found that they became incredibly resilient. And they were able to handle bending and stretching with little or no effect to the properties. You know, they would do a conductivity test before they bent it and after they bent it. And they found that, you know, one of the samples that they tweaked a lot only dropped by 1%, which is significant. It means that, you know, you'd be able to make things with this process, like, you know, make complex shapes and things like that with this process.
Yeah.
And what they did was they went as far as making a paper airplane out of this process sprayed onto paper. And the guy folded it into a paper airplane, hooked up two electrodes to it, flashed a flashlight on it, mm-hmm. and the thing was conducting. It was doing it very well. So one last quick note. The researchers did note that the paper is not typically considered a good substrate for photovoltaics because it's not transparent. And this was the joke that Steve brought up before. However, the ability to print low-cost solar cells on something flexible and stretchable is going to have widespread use. You know, this is just the beginning of us finding all sorts of ways and places to put these types of solar collecting. So, I mean, imagine you have a car that this has been spray painted on.
Yeah, yep. Or every inch of your house. Or don't. So, I think that, you know, we like to talk about solar energy news items, but it really is just the sexy poster child for this type of technology in general. Essentially, printing electronics or putting electronics onto conductive material, onto flexible material, and who knows? This is now this is one process. There are others. It's hard to say which ones are going to scale up or be industrialized better. Again, it's more like just this type of thing that's really interesting. That's not necessarily the specific process. And people will figure out interesting ways to use it. We probably don't know yet, or no one's thought of yet, what the real killer apps are going to be for this kind of thing. But it does hold out the promise or the potential for having cheap solar cells that can be in many, many locations, that you could basically cover your house with it, for example. Well, let's move on. Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Ooh, it's one of my favorite times of the whole show. So let's play the reminder for everyone. And here we go. Last week's Who's That Noisy?
Bullfrog? Is it a bullfrog?
No, not a bullfrog.
Is it some kind of animal?
It is an animal. Yep. Someone actually got it right.
An emu?
An emu, yes. Emu noises.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that.
Actually. I ate one of those.
I did too, and it was good.
Yeah, I like the crocodile better.
Yeah, me too.
I wasn't crazy.
I like vegetables.
I like it. I thought it was good. I had a lot of spices and flavors with it. But
kiwi fruit?
I don't know. I was crocodile, then kangaroo, then emu of the three Australian exotic meat that we ate.
And why is it as corny as it may sound? Why is it that a lot of things do taste like chicken? That's so weird.
Because it's all meat.
Protein structure.
I guess there's only so many different kinds of meat. There's like red meat and white meat, right?
What about the other meat? Well, there's bacon. You know, and that just is
its own thing. So was that an emu doing anything in particular, Evan, or just sort of walking around making noises?
Yeah, that was our good friend Fred Bremer, who was, while he was in Australia, got some footage, actually video footage, and that was the audio portion.
I was there. I was there when he took that.
Oh, my God.
I just remember it.
I was standing like 10 feet away, I think, when he shot that.
Before the audio that Evan played, you can hear Rebecca say, "Hey, isn't that an emu over there?"
Listen to that funny sound the emu's making. Ha ha.
Yep. I clipped that part out, of course.
So who got that?
Taswegian. Taswegian from the message boards.
Alrighty.
And
Taz. So we'll call him Taz.
Taz. Let's...
What do you got for this week?
All right, for this week.
No, no. None of these books have a cure. Ugh, there has to be a real reason for this. An illness? An allergy? A curse? I said a real reason. Something that points to something real.
How about this one?
Supernaturals? Spike, the word supernatural refers to things like ghosts and spirits and zombies, which are as make-believe as curses. This book is just a bunch of hooey.
Well, whatever that was, I liked it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very cool.
I approve.
All right, everyone. Go on. Give it your best shot. Good luck.
Thanks, Evan. We have time for one question this week. This comes from Tristan McMillan, St. Mary's International School in Tokyo, Japan. Tristan writes a long email. I'm going to cut to the chase here. Tristan writes, "This Christmas break, I was back home in Indiana hanging out with some college friends who are now in grad school. We were having a late-night beer-fueled philosophical discussion about science, and my friends started going on and on about Thomas Kuhn and how he proved that science was not cumulative, inherently flawed, and just one of many equally valid human perspectives. As a skeptic, I took issue with this, and a friendly but heated debate ensued. I think it was a tie, but I would have done better had I understood Kuhn's real argument. The version my friends were using seemed to be either flawed from the start or misinterpreted. Could the SGU host explain what Thomas Kuhn was trying to say in Structures of Scientific Revolutions, and also give your take on why you think postmodernists in the academic humanities, my friends and their teachers, have chosen him as their guide when they want to criticize science? Cheers." Yeah, this is a big one, right? We often complain about the misuse of Thomas Kuhn's work by postmodernists, essentially trying to say that science is all relative, it has no special relationship to the truth, that scientists essentially jump from theory to theory for quirky reasons, and no one theory is better than the other. Therefore, of course, you could believe whatever you want, and whatever you believe is just as valid as anything the scientists say. So this is very useful for anti-scientists or people who just want to believe whatever they want to believe. But that, of course, is not what Thomas Kuhn wrote, and it certainly is not what he believed. And independently of what Thomas Kuhn believed, it's also just not valid. So first, just a little background. Kuhn wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in 1962. He was actually a physicist, but also apparently a philosopher. And he was writing about the history of science, and you know, his book was seminal in that it really, you know, took a very historical view about how science progresses over time. You know, prior to that, I would say the more naive sense is that science is inherently progressive. you know, that sort of relentlessly, constantly, you know, progressing. And Kuhn is pointing out that there's actually structure to the way science progresses over time. It's not just this simple, relentless, you know, progressive pattern. And, you know, he pointed out that there are different phases of scientific progress. He used the term paradigm to refer to, you know, more than just a theory, but like a whole way of looking at a problem in science and how scientists approach answering questions and making predictions, etc. So like relativity is a paradigm, you know, or plate tectonics, you know, really big, or catastrophism, you know, big ways of explaining things in science. And what he said was that there's this pre-paradigm phase where there really isn't even a well-fleshed out theory yet. There are just observations and ideas about what might be going on. In this phase, you know, essentially anything goes. It's very chaotic. But then eventually the scientific community will settle upon one consensus paradigm or theory. And then that will, scientific progress will transition into the second phase, which he called normal science. You know, normal science is what's happening most of the time, where scientists are problem solving. They're using the scientific theories in order to make predictions and figure out how stuff works, and everything is fine. However, within theories, during this phase, often what happens is that certain anomalies crop up. The theory can't explain every observation or experiment. Sometimes you can solve those by making tweaks, etc., but often what happens is that these anomalies build and build and build until the theory is in crisis. And then what happens is there is a paradigm shift. And he called this revolutionary science, where there's a shift to an entirely new paradigm or new way of explaining things that hopefully resolves the anomalies that were plaguing the previous theory. That's where, you know, the postmodernists say, well, see, one paradigm is just as good as another paradigm. It just, you know, shifts from one to the other for arbitrary, you know, subjective or cultural reasons. But that became the real focus of the debate, is what's the relationship between one theory and another. Now, Kuhn was actually very clear about this, and in later editions of The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and in articles that he wrote, he unequivocally endorsed the notion that science is progressive and that there are ways of objectively distinguishing among theories. For example, he wrote that you take a hypothesis, this is a good way of thinking about it. You take a hypothetical situation of presenting somebody with three theories that were held at different historical times, but in one area. And you present them to somebody who doesn't know anything about that science or the history of that question, and see if they can put those theories into the correct historical sequence. Now, Kuhn argued that you would be able to do that. You would be able to see the inherent superiority of the more recent theories over the older theories. Whereas a true postmodernist would say you couldn't do that. The theories would be, you know, equivalent in terms of their validity. They would just be different. So Kuhn was clearly not a postmodernist in that sense, and he was clearly a progressivist. He's also been highly criticized. You know, he's been criticized by later scientists and philosophers who said that he overemphasized a few things. Science is not just this inexorably slowly progressive process, that it is punctuated by these paradigm shifts or these. But he overemphasized that as well, and in fact, that's not always what happens. It's not always the case that a scientific theory gets into an utter crisis because of anomalies and then has to undergo a major shift or a major metamorphosis. These shifts occur in every size or degree. There really is no threshold or cutoff. Scientific theories are constantly making small shifts, and they may be sometimes slightly bigger ones and rarely even bigger ones. So there isn't really this clean demarcation between normal science and revolutionary science. There's actually a continuum or a spectrum between the two. The last thing I'm going to talk about is that there was a major controversy over this notion of incommensurability. Now, Kuhn said that within the within one paradigm, you can't really evaluate another paradigm. That paradigms are sort of mutually exclusive, that you can't even, you know, use the ideas and methods of one paradigm to assess the validity of another. And that's where postmodernists really focus their attention, because they can say, see, you know, it's all completely isolated, independent ideas, and you can't really even compare one theory to the other one. But then again, Kuhn really went against that in his later editions and later writings. He actually outlined a very, you know, reasonable method for comparing theories. You know, for example, he had, I don't think this is a complete list, but he had his five criteria by which you can objectively value or judge a theory compared to another one. For example, how accurate is it? You know, how accurate is it in terms of experiment and observation? Is it internally consistent? Does it have a broad scope? Is it a good theory? Should have consequences that extend beyond the purpose for which the theory was originally developed? Is it simple, basically Occam's razor? Is it a simple and elegant explanation that's not unnecessarily complicated? And is it fruitful? Does it actually lead to the discovery of new phenomenon? And does it predict, you know, new relationships? So again, it's a very elaborate way of saying that you can actually compare one theory to another and decide that one is superior to the other. And that's sort of the core of progress in science. And also, you know, again, later philosophers have said, you know, the whole idea that you can't evaluate one paradigm from within another is actually not true. It's just not correct. You can certainly find common ground of, you know, basically observation and experimentation from which you can compare two or more theories. So bottom line is, it's not even an accurate portrayal of what Thomas Kuhn was saying. Later scientists and philosophers have actually moved well beyond Kuhn's ideas, and the postmodernists in the humanities that are using it as a way of saying science has no validity are more than a half a century out of date in their thinking, and were not even accurate as far as that goes, even at the time. They're inaccurate for 1962, and they're a half a century out of date. It's really just a pretty anti-intellectual way of dismissing the very real validity of science.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for a new year of science or fiction?
Let's do
yes.
it.
Let's do it.
So ready.
Okay. Item number one. New research finds that hair color can be predicted with 80 to 90% accuracy from DNA analysis alone. Item number two, the longest follow-up study of cholesterol and heart disease published to date failed to show any protective effect for increased levels of HDL, or so-called good cholesterol. And item number three, researchers have developed a prototype invisibility cloak, but this one can render a submerged object invisible to sonar. Jay, go first.
All right. So the first item, researchers found that they can predict the hair color with 80 to 90% accuracy from DNA analysis alone. I would imagine, being that it seems that hair color is hereditary, that absolutely they could predict that with DNA. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Item number two, the longest follow-up study about cholesterol and heart disease. Basically what that's saying is, if you have good or adequate levels of HDL, it does not help in any way to prevent heart disease. Wow. That would really suck if that's true. And I don't see any reason why an extensive follow-up study couldn't disprove something that we previously thought was true. So I'm not sure about that one. And the final one was researchers had developed a prototype invisibility cloak, but this one can render a submerged object invisible to sonar. I mean, there's so many things about this one that I just want to flat out say, it's bullshit. Right? I mean, the whole invisibility cloak thing, you know, I'm surprised you didn't mention Harry Potter in this. You know, if Harry Potter owned a submarine, this is what his would be like, you know? I mean, it would be cool, but what are they talking? When you say invisibility cloak, you're not actually saying it's made out of what, right? You're not telling us what it's made out of. You're not saying, it could be literally like the paint job on the submarine. So it's hard to speculate on this one because I don't actually know what the thing is. When you say cloak, you know, it's in parentheses in Steve's write-up that he sent us. So that doesn't mean anything to me other than undefined thing. Mm-hmm. The cloak could be anything. So just by that alone, I don't think I can pick this item because it just makes me there's so much unknown with that one, I probably should just leave it alone.
It's almost invisible to you.
That's true. So I think because of that, I'm going to go with the HDL one because I don't think that we would have been that wrong for this long.
Okay, Bob.
Wow, I find myself agreeing with Jay a little bit on some of this. The hair color one, yeah, that doesn't surprise me that they could have nailed that with that accuracy, especially since it is inherited. And yeah, I mean that just doesn't faze me at all. The third one, the invisibility cloak. Yeah, Jay, haven't you been listening to me in the past couple of years? I mean, this is obviously and most likely some new metamaterial that can guide sound waves around an object. No problem. Perfectly plausible. I mean, if we could guide light around objects, I mean, doing it with sound seems a little bit easier to me. The second one, yeah, Jay, I agree with you on this. I would think that we would have had this nailed with the HDL, the high density lipoprotein. I can't imagine we were that wrong. I could see them refining the protective effect of HDL, but I just can't imagine that it's got that it just wiped out any protection at all. So I'm going to have to say that that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
When you mentioned the invisibility cloak, I was thinking more not of a piece of cloth or material or something. I was thinking maybe it's a field, like a force field or something, you know, more like what you would see in like a science fiction space technology, that they sort of put this dampening field around the object or something that, so in the terms of it being a cloak, yes, it cloaks it, but not in a material physical way, more like a force field. So I think that one is science. The DNA analysis for hair color, sure. I mean, they just found the rungs of the DNA ladder. They've nailed it down and they've figured out which ones exactly, I suppose, are the indicators for the hair color. All that's left is the HDL one. And fail to show any protective effect? Well, like the guys were saying, I don't know about that. It's got to be still some protective effect. Like you'd have to totally throw it into reverse at this point to say that that one is correct. So that one's got to be the fiction.
All righty, Rebecca?
I hadn't considered it until Evan just said this, but I quite like the idea of a submarine or something wearing a tiny little coat in order to be invisible. But that makes sense to me. Like Bob said, you know, we've all heard the news. We talk about it every time it comes up. but that, you know, they can bend light around things. Sound, for some reason to me, sound seems like an even easier job. So I can believe that. I can also believe the hair color thing. That makes sense to me. I'm going with the crowd, Steve. I'm going with the crowd. I'm saying that HDL is still, in fact, good cholesterol.
Yeah, Rebecca.
Word.
Okay.
Yeah, your majesty.
Let's take these in order. Item number one, new research finds that hair color can be predicted with 80 to 90% accuracy from DNA analysis alone. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay.
Yay.
Don't get too excited.
Sorry.
Okay. Boo.
So, yeah, the thing is that obviously, you know, hair color is genetic, so it makes sense that we would be able to do this, and of course now we can. But this is, you know, fairly challenging because there are many genes that interact to control hair color. So this is not so straightforward. This took quite a bit of research. The accuracy with which researchers are able to predict hair color from gene sequencing depends on the hair color. For redheads, it's 90%.
Woohoo.
And similar for black hair, and it's about 80% for blonde or brown. They're saying in some cases they could even tell the difference between, say, a light blonde and a dark blonde hair. So this is obviously useful for forensic analysis. If you can get the DNA of the perp, you know, you could describe them to some degree. You could say not only is it, you know, male and male or female, for example, you could say it's, you know, a redheaded male. I mean, that could, you know, narrow the field a little bit. This comes on the heels of prior research, which showed that it's possible to predict eye color from just looking at the genes. Eye color was a little bit of an easier task because there are some fairly dominant genes, you know, that control eye color. But it is there again, like hair color, there are actually many genes that interact in a complex way to determine eye color. So, you know, it took a fairly extensive data set in order to be able to come up with some kind of, you know, algorithm that that makes that prediction. But they did it.
Done.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those things where you wonder, is this research avenue going to continue in this direction in 10 or 20 or 30 years? How much we'll be able to tell about somebody just from sequencing their DNA? Imagine how accurate a picture we'll be able to get.
Yep. Very accurate, I would hope.
Gattaca.
All right, let's go on to number two. The longest follow-up study of cholesterol and heart disease published to date failed to show any protective effect for increased levels of HDL or so-called good cholesterol. You guys all think this one is the fiction. You know, I think you guys were glossing over the fact that this study failed to show a protective effect. That's not the same thing as saying that it shows that there is no protective effect. It could just be that it was not detected by the study.
No, we get it, Steve. Mm-hmm. We get it.
That's true.
We still say bunk.
Yes.
Bunk, right. Steve.
Well, this one is the fiction.
Yeah. 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 I wasn't worried.
It was an 80
2011 is a bust for Steve.
So far, yeah, you guys are starting with a sweep. Well done. So what's interesting is this was a study following up from one that was published. The study published in 1966 that, again, showed that certain types of HDL, HDL type 2 and 3, are associated with lower risks of heart disease. There were 1,900 people entered in this study. And the researcher who did the study went on to other things and passed away, actually. Huh. However, another researcher...
High cholesterol, probably.
...found the punch cards from this study collecting dust on a shelf somewhere... And
where'd he find a machine to put them in?
Yeah, they found a punch card machine to translate the data.
The UNIVAC.
Wow.
So they had...
There's an iPhone app for that.
They had this study data on 1,900 people, and they realized that, wow, this is an epidemiological gold mine. We have all this data on 1,900 people from this so long ago. So they actually spent 9 years tracking down these people.
Oh, cool.
And getting follow-up data on them. Basically, you know, how many of them went on to have heart disease. And this actually confirmed the protective effects of HDL type 2 and type 3 in lowering heart disease risk.
There you go.
Wow.
So actually supporting the previous study and consistent with, you know, interim research. It's very interesting. But I thought it was funny that the whole punch card thing. It was a nice angle to the story. Which means researchers have developed a prototype invisibility cloak, but this one can render a submerged object invisible to sonar. So an actual prototype.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
This one, of course, is science. But yeah, that was the bit I was hoping you would find a little extraordinary. Yeah, Bob's exactly right. This is a metamaterial that causes sound waves to bend around an object. Essentially, the material is constructed in such a way that sound waves, it takes more energy to travel through the material as you get closer and closer to the center, and therefore that tends to keep the sound waves pushed to the outside, which is just the pathway of least resistance, and therefore you can use that to cause the sound waves to just go around an object so that the object is rendered invisible to essentially sonar, to bouncing sound waves off of it to see it.
This will also be put to good use by ventriloquists.
Yes, right.
Jeff Dunham is about to get much better. That's not true, actually.
No. So they're calling this an acoustic cloak. It can function over a broad range of sound wavelengths from 40 to 80 kilohertz. Although they say, of course, with modification, could theoretically be tuned to cover tens of megahertz. So this could be, you know, the obvious application would be for
Military.
Military submarines.
What else?
Yeah, to render them invisible to sonar.
Cool.
Very interesting.
All right, that's cool.
Yeah, so good job, everyone. All right. Nice. Off to a good start this year. Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I got a quote. This one is from someone called P.C. Hodgel. That which can be destroyed by the truth should be. P.C. Hodgel!
That was a short one.
That was very short.
It was good. I liked it.
It was pithy.
That one was for Rebecca.
Thank you, Jay.
Steve, I have a couple of announcements.
Go ahead, Jay.
So Nexus 2011 is coming up in April. The dates are April 9th and 10th. We expanded it to a two-day event.
And there's another conference coming up actually even before Nexus. This is the QED Con. You can get information at qedcon.org. QED stands for Question, Explore, Discover. This is an event put together by the Northwest Skeptical Events Limited for the Greater Manchester Skeptic Society and the Merseyside Skeptic Society. This is February 5th and 6th. So just a month from now in Piccadilly Hotel, Manchester. And I will be there. I will be speaking at the conference. I know that George Hrob will also be there. And it looks like there's a good lineup. So if you can make it to the area, I will be there. Eugenie Scott, John Ronson, Bruce Hood, a lot of Simon Singh, George Hrob, as I said, Christopher French. So David Kirby. That's not the same David Kirby I'm thinking of, though.
No.
That's interesting. Not the crank journalist, anti-vaccine guy, but some other David Kirby. Senior lecturer in science communication at the University of Manchester. I wonder if he knows that he shares
poor
his
guy.
Name. Yeah, with an anti-vaxxer. Yeah, so it looks like it's going to be a fun time.
Awesome.
Hey, guys, a friend of mine named Joshie Berger is on a TV show called The Worst Cooks in America, and that's on the Food Network. The show first aired on Sunday the 2nd. That was last Sunday. It'll be on, I think it's got 7 more episodes to go. So I just wanted to show Joshie some support. He's a fellow skeptic. He's part of the New York City Skeptics. And hopefully Joshie will do really good on the show. The guy's crazy funny, and I just want to recommend that everyone watch Joshie on there.
Well, thanks for joining me again, everyone, this week.
Thank you, Shirley. Steve.
Thanks, well Steve.
Nice job.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.